over her breasts. She gasped, and at the sound, all of my recent worry, fear, anger, pain, it all faded away, burned to ash by a sudden fire of raw need. To feel her under my hand again, to have the scent of her filling my head. I dreamed of it on too many cold and lonely nights. It wasn't the smart thing to do. It was the only thing. I slid both hands around her body, teasing her breasts, loving the way their tips hardened to rounded points beneath my fingers. She tried to turn on me again, but I jerked her back hard against me, my mouth pressing against the side of her throat, keeping her from turning her head. It only excited her more. "Need," she whispered, panting. "Need you. Don't stop." I wasn't sure I could have. I couldn't get enough of the taste of her onto my lips. Impatient, I shoved her shirt up over her breasts to the top of her back and spent a slow and delicious moment following the line of her spine with my lips and tongue, tasting her skin, testing its texture with my teeth. Some part of me struggled to remember to be gentle. Another part didn't give a damn. Feel. Taste. Indulge. My teeth left small marks here and there on her skin, and I remember thinking that they looked intriguing beside the curling scarlet designs that swept in a spiral around her body. The dark leather of her pants blocked my mouth, a sudden ugliness beneath my lips, and I straightened with a snarl to get it out of my way. For the record, tight leather pants don't come off easily. Berserk lust is likely not the best frame of mind for removing them. I didn't let that stop me. She gasped when I started taking them off, started squirming and wriggling, trying to help me. Mostly it just drove me insane as she brushed against me, as I watched her move in sinuous, delicious need. Her panting gasps all had a quiet vocalization to them now, a sound that both spoke of her need and urged me on. I got the pants down over her hips. There wasn't anything else beneath them. I shivered and paused to spend another moment savoring her with my hands. My mouth, placing delicate kisses around the scrapes, biting at unmarred skin to elicit more desperate movements, louder moans. The scent of her was driving me insane. "Now," she whispered, a frenzied edge to her voice. "Now." But I didn't hurry. I don't know how long I stood there, kissing, touching, driving her cries into higher and more desperate pitches. All I knew was that something I'd wanted, needed, longed for, had come to me again. At that moment, there was nothing on earth, in heaven or hell, that meant more to me. She looked over her shoulder at me, eyes black and burning with hunger. She tried for my hand again, driven beyond words now. I had to control her head again, fingers knotted into her hair, while my free hand got the interfering clothes out of the way. She let out mewling sounds of raw need until I pulled her hips back against me, feeling my way, and in a rush of fire and silk felt my hardness press into her. Her eyes flew open wide, out of focus, and she cried out, moving against me, meeting my motion with her own. I had a fleeting thought of slowing down. I didn't. Neither of us wanted that. I took her that way, my mouth on her ear, her throat, one hand in her hair, her hand stretched out over her, body straining back to meet mine. God, she was beautiful. She screamed and started shuddering, and it was all I could do not to explode. I fought away the inevitable for a little time more. Susan sagged down for a moment until, with my hands, with my mouth, with the thrusts of my body, I kindled the quiet moans once again to cries of need. She screamed again, the motions of her body swift, liquid, desperate, and there wasn't any way I could keep her from driving me over the brink with her. Our cries mingled together as we intertwined. The strain of muscles and bodies and hungers overwhelmed me. Pleasure, like fire, consumed us both and burned my thoughts to ash. Time drifted by and did not touch us. When I recovered my senses, I found myself on the floor. Susan lay on her stomach beneath me, her still-bound arms laid out above her head. Not much time had passed. Both of us were still short of breath. I shivered and felt myself still inside her. I didn't remember releasing the spell that held the bonds up to the ceiling, but I must have done it. I moved my head to kiss her shoulder, her cheek, very softly. Her eyes blinked slowly open, human again, though her pupils were dilated until they all but hid the dark brown of her irises. She didn't focus them. She smiled and made a soft sound, somewhere between a moan and a cat's purr. I stared at her for a moment until I realized that the designs on her face had gone dark again and had begun to fade away. As I watched over the next few moments, they vanished completely.
"I love you," she whispered.
"I love you."
"Wanted that."
"Me too," I said.
"Dangerous. Harry, you could have been hurt. I might have..."
I leaned down and kissed the corner of her mouth, silencing her. "You didn't. It's okay." She shivered, but nodded.
"So tired."
I felt like nothing more than dropping off to sleep, but instead I got to my feet. Susan let out a soft sound, half pleasure and half protest. I gathered her up and put her on the couch. I touched the rope, willing it to release her, and it slid away from her skin, coiling itself into neat loops in my hand. I pulled a blanket from the back of the couch and folded it over her.
"Sleep," I said. "Get some rest."
"You should..."
"I will, promise. But I don't think it would be a good idea to go to sleep near you."
Susan nodded wearily.
"You're right. I'm sorry."
"It's okay," I said.
"I should call Martin."
"The phone won't call out," I said. "Not until the defenses go down." I didn't think her voice sounded particularly disappointed as she snuggled down a bit more onto my couch.
"Oh," she said, "we'll have to wait it out then."
"Yeah," I said. I stroked her hair. "Susan?" She touched my hand with hers and closed her eyes.
"It's all right. I told you I'd never be able to separate the hungers with you. It was a release. Took some of the pressure off me. I wanted it. Needed it."
"Did I hurt you?" She made a purring sound without opening her eyes.
"Maybe a little. I didn't mind."
I shivered and said,
"You're okay?"
She nodded slowly.
"As I can be. Get some rest, Harry."
"Yeah," I said. I touched her hair again, and then shuffled into my bedroom. I didn't shut the door. I put my pillows at the foot of my bed so that I could see the couch when I lay down. I watched her face, graced by pale candlelight, until my eyes closed. She was so lovely. I wished that she were with me. Chapter 26. I opened my eyes a while later and saw Susan standing in the living room, her eyes closed. She was crouched, her hands held before her, as if grasping an invisible basketball. As I watched, she moved, arms and legs gliding through gentle, circular motions. Tai Chi. It was a meditative form of exercise that had originally come from martial arts. Lots of people who practiced Tai Chi didn't realize that the movements they followed were beautiful, slow-motion renditions of bone-breaking throws and joint locks. I had a feeling Susan knew. She wore her t-shirt and a pair of my running shorts. She moved with the graceful simplicity of a natural talent honed by training. A turn showed me her face, her expression set in peaceful concentration. I spent a minute watching her in silence, cataloging my own aches and pains. She suddenly smiled without opening her eyes and said,
"Don't start drooling, Harry."
"My house, I can drool as much as I want."
"What was that rope you used?"
she asked, still going through her routine.
"I've broken handcuffs before. Magic?"
"Shop talk." I had hoped for some other kind of discussion. Or maybe I'd been nervous about it. Work talk held a certain appeal for me, too. It was safe. "Fairy make," I said, "has hair from a unicorn's mane woven through it."
"Really?"
I shrugged. "That's what Fix said. I imagine he knows."
"Would be handy to have around if the Denarian showed up again, don't you think?"
"Not unless they came here," I told her. "It's set to this place. Take it out of here and it wouldn't work." Why not? Because I'm not that good yet, I said. It's easy to make something that works at home. Takes a lot more know-how than I have to take an enchantment on the road. I got out of bed and got moving. The clock said that it wasn't yet 10 in the morning. I hopped in and out of the shower, dressed, slapped a comb through my hair, and decided that the rakish, unshaven look was in. By the time I got back out into the living room, Susan was dressed in the leather pants again, and only 4 or 5 candles were still lit. The defensive barriers were winding down. "What happened after Martin took off from the hotel?" I asked. Susan slouched into a chair.
"I tried to get him to stop. He wouldn't. We fought about it, and he put a gun in my face."
I choked. "He what?"
To be fair, I wasn't being very rational.
Hell's bells.
Martin didn't want to, but I convinced him to go to Michael's place. I figured if anyone could get you out of a mess with the Denarians, it would be him.
"Seems reasonable to me," I said. I debated between coffee and cola. The Coke won by virtue of convenience. Susan nodded at me before I could get the question out of my mouth, and I got her one, too.
"What about Anna Valmont?" "She was in shock. Charity put her to bed."
"Did you call the police?" Susan shook her head.
"I thought she might have known something that would help. We wouldn't be able to find out what it was if she was angry and locked away."
"What did Michael have to say about it?"
"He wasn't there," Susan said. "Shiro was. Charity said that Michael and someone named Sonia hadn't come back from St. Louis and hadn't called."
I frowned and passed over the second can to her. "That doesn't sound like him."
"I know. They were worried," she frowned. "Or Charity was. I don't think Shiro was worried at all. It was almost as though he'd been expecting all of it. He was still dressed in the samurai clothes, and he opened the front door before I could knock."
"Michael's done that kind of thing before. Fringe benefit of his job, maybe." Susan shook her head.
"God works in mysterious ways?"
I shrugged. "Maybe so. Did Shiro say anything?"
"He just told Martin where to turn left or right and where to park. Then he told me to give him 2 minutes lead and to get ready to get you back to the car. He just smiled a little, the whole time. It would have been a little spooky on anyone else. He seemed content. Maybe he just had a good poker face."
I toyed with my can.
He has a good poker face."
Susan arched an eyebrow.
"I don't understand."
"I don't think he's dead. Not yet.
He agreed to give himself over to the Denarians in exchange for them letting me go.
The head Denarian guy, said his name was Nicodemus, made Shiro promise not to fight back or escape for 24 hours.
"That doesn't sound good."
I shivered. "Yeah, I figure they're arch-enemies. When Shiro offered himself, Nicodemus looked like a kid on Christmas morning."
Susan sipped at her drink. "How bad are these people?"
I thought of Nicodemus and his knife, of the sheer helplessness I'd felt as he drew my head back, baring my throat. I thought of sliced and diced corpses. "Bad." Susan regarded me quietly for a moment while I stared at my drink.
"Harry," she said finally, "you going to open that or just look at it?"
I shook my head and popped a tab on the can. My wrists felt sore, and the skin around them had been pretty thoroughly abraded. Evidently, Nicodemus preferred regular old ropes to special unicorn mane custom jobs.
"Sorry, got a lot to think about." "Yeah," she said, her own voice softening. "What's our next move?"
I checked the candles. 3 to go. "Barrier will go down in maybe 20 minutes. We'll call a cab, pick up the beetle at McAnally's, and head to Michael's place."
"What if the Denarians are waiting outside for us?"
I picked up my blasting rod from the stand in the corner by the door and twirled it around in my fingers.
"They'll have to find their own cab." "And then?"
I picked up my staff and leaned it against the wall by the door.
"We tell Michael and Sonia what happened. Assuming they're back."
"Uh-huh." I opened the kitchen drawer and got out my gun and its holster.
"After that, I asked the nice Denarians to let Shiro go."
Susan nodded.
"We ask?"
I flipped open the cylinder on the gun and loaded it.
"I'll say pretty please," I said, and snapped the cylinder shut again.
Susan's eyes flashed.
"Count me in."
She watched me while I put on a shoulder rig and slipped the gun into it.
"Harry,"
she said. I don't want to break up the righteous vengeance vibe, but there are a couple of questions that are really bothering me. Why do the Denarians want the shroud, and what are they going to do with it? I said.
Yeah.
I got an old squall jacket out of my room and slid it on. It felt wrong. I hadn't worn anything but my old canvas duster or the newer leather one Susan had given me for the past several years. I checked the candles, and they had all gone out. I laid my hand on the wall, feeling for the defenses. There was a faint echo of them left, but nothing of substance. So I went back out into the living room and called for a cab. We're good to go. I think I've got an idea of what they're doing, but I can't be sure. She straightened my jacket collar absently.
Very sloppy of you. Didn't you get the megalomaniacal bragfest from this Nicodemus?
He must have read that evil overlord list.
Sounds like someone who intends to get things done.
He sure as hell had. He let a couple things slip. I think we can get ahead of him. She shook her head.
Harry, when I went down there with Shiro, I didn't see much. But I heard their voices through the tunnels. There was...
She closed her eyes for a moment, her expression one of faint nausea.
It's hard for me to explain. Their voices gave me a strong impression. Shiro sounded like, I don't know, a trumpet, clear and strong. The other one, his voice stank. It was rotted, corrupt.
I didn't understand what would have made Susan say that. Maybe it was something that the vampires had done to her. Maybe it was something she'd learned between Tai Chi classes. Maybe it was just pure intuition. But I knew what she was talking about. There was a sense to Nicodemus, of something quiet and still and dangerous, of something patient and vile and malicious beyond the scope of mortal understanding. He scared the hell out of me.
I know what you mean. Nicodemus isn't another misguided idealist or some greedy bastard out to make money, I said. He's different.
Susan nodded.
Evil.
And he plays hardball. I wasn't sure if I was asking Susan or myself, but I said, You ready? She got her jacket on, I went to the door, and she followed.
The one bad thing about the duster, she mused, I could never see your butt.
I never noticed.
If you went around noticing your own ass, I'd worry about you, Harry.
I looked over my shoulder at her, smiling. She smiled back. It didn't last long. Both of our smiles turned a little sad. Susan, I said. She put two fingertips to my lips.
Don't. Damn it, Susan. Last night shouldn't have happened, she said.
Her voice sounded tired, but her eyes stayed steady on mine.
It doesn't change anything, I finished.
I sounded bitter, even to me. She took her hand away and buttoned up the dark leather jacket.
Right, I said.
I should have stuck to shop talk. I opened the door and looked outside.
Cab's here. Let's get to work.
Chapter 27 I grabbed my staff, blasting rod, and Shiro's cane, and made a note to get myself a freaking golf bag. We took the cab to McAnally's. The Blue Beetle was still in the nearby lot, and it hadn't been stolen, vaporized, or otherwise mishandled.
What happened to your back window? Susan asked.
One of Marcone's goons winged a few shots at me outside the Larry Fowler studio. Susan's mouth twitched.
You went on Larry Fowler again?
I don't want to talk about it.
Uh-huh. And what about the hood?
Little holes are from Marcone's thug. Big Dent was a chlorofiend, I said.
A what?
Plant monster.
Oh, why don't you just say plant monster?
I have my pride.
Your poor car.
I got out my keys, but Susan put her hand on mine and walked a circle around the car. She crouched down and looked beneath it a couple of times, then said, Okay. I got in. Thank you, 007, but no one bombs a Volkswagen. They're too cute. Susan got in the passenger door and said,
Cute confetti if you aren't careful, Harry.
I grunted, revved up the car, and puttered to Michael's place. The morning was cold and clear. Winter hadn't yet given up its grip on the Great Lakes, and where Lake Michigan went, Chicago went too. Susan got out and looked around the front lawn, frowning from behind black sunglasses. How does he manage to make this place so nice, run his own business, and fight demons on the side?
He probably watches a lot of those home and garden shows, I said.
She frowned. The grass is green. It's February, and his grass is green. Doesn't that strike you as strange?
Sod works in mysterious ways. She made a disgusted sound and then followed me up the walk to the door. I knocked. A moment later, Father Forthill said, Who's there?
Donnie and Marie, I responded. Salt and Peppa asked us to fill in for them.
He opened the door, smiling from behind his gold-rimmed glasses. He was the same short, stocky, balding old Forthill, but he looked strained and tired. The lines of his face had grown deeper than I remembered.
Hello, Harry.
Father, I said, you know Susan? He looked at her thoughtfully.
By reputation, he said.
Come in, come in. We did, and as I came in, Forthill set a Louisville Slugger baseball bat down in the corner. I raised my eyebrows, traded a look with Susan, and then put my staff and Shiro's cane beside the bat. We followed Forthill into the kitchen.
Where's Charity? I asked.
Taking the children to her mother's house, Forthill said. She should be back soon. I let out a breath of relief.
Anna Valmont?
Guest room, sleeping.
I need to call Martin, Susan said. Excuse me.
She stepped aside into the small study.
Coffee? Donut?
Father Forthill asked. I sat down at the table. Father, you've never been closer to converting me. He laughed.
The fantastic Forthill, saving souls one Danish at a time.
He produced the nectar of the gods themselves in Dunkin' Donuts paper sacks and styrofoam cups, taking some for himself as well.
I've always admired your ability to make jokes when faced with adversity. Matters are grave.
I sure have noticed, I said through a mouthful of glazed donut. Where's Michael?
He and Sonia went to St. Louis to investigate possible Denarian activity. They were both arrested by the local police.
They what? What for?
No charges were filed, Forthill said. They were arrested, held for 24 hours, and released.
Sand trap, I said. Someone wanted them out of the way.
Forthill nodded.
So it would seem. I spoke to them about 2 hours ago. They're on their way back now and should be here soon.
Then as soon as they get here, we have to go get Shiro back.
Forthill frowned and nodded.
What happened to you last night?
I told him the short version, all about the art auction and the Denarians, but I elided over the details afterward, which were none of his chaste business, and which would have embarrassed me to tell. I'm not particularly religious, but come on, the man was a priest. When I finished, Forthill took off his glasses and stared hard at me. He had eyes the color of robin's eggs, and they could be disturbingly intense.
Nicodemus, he said quietly.
Are you sure that is what he called himself?
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, we had a nice chat.
Forthill folded his hands and exhaled slowly.
Mother of God. Harry, could you describe him for me?
I did, while the old priest listened.
Oh, and he was always wearing a rope around his neck. Not like a ship's hawser, a thin rope, like clothesline. I thought it was a string tie at first.
Forthill's fingers reached up to touch the crucifix at his throat.
Tied in a noose?
Yeah.
What did you think of him? He asked.
I looked down at my half-eaten donut.
He scared the hell out of me.
He's bad, I guess.
Wrong.
The word you're looking for is evil, Harry. I shrugged, ate the rest of the donut, and didn't argue.
Nicodemus is an ancient foe of the Knights of the Cross, Forthill said quietly.
Our information about him is limited. He has made it a point to find and destroy our archives every other century or so, so we cannot be sure who he is or how long he has been alive. He may even have walked the earth when the Savior was crucified.
Didn't look a day over 500, I mumbled. How come some knight hasn't gone and parted his hair for him?
They've tried, Forthill said.
He's gotten away?
Forthill's eyes and voice stayed steady.
He's killed them.
He's killed all of them. More than 100 knights. More than 1,000 priests, nuns, and monks.
3,000 men, women, children. And those are only the ones listed in the pages recovered from the destroyed archives. Only two knights have ever faced him and survived. I had a flash of insight. Shiro is one of them. That's why Nicodemus was willing to trade me for him. Fort Hill nodded and closed his eyes for a moment.
Likely, though the Denarians grow in power by inflicting pain and suffering on others, they become better able to use the strength the fallen give them, and they gain the most from hurting those meant to counter them.
He's torturing Shiro, I said. Fort Hill put his hand on mine for a moment, his voice quiet, calming.
We must have faith. We may be in time to help him.
I thought the whole point of the knights was to deal out justice, I said. The fists of God and all that. So why is it that Nicodemus can slaughter them wholesale?
For much the same reason any man can kill another, Fort Hill said. He is intelligent, cautious, skilled, ruthless, like his patron fallen angel.
I guessed at the name. Badass Hill? Fort Hill almost smiled.
And Uriel. He was a captain of Lucifer's after the fall.
And Uriel leads the 30 fallen who inhabit the coins. Nicodemus wasn't seduced into Anduriel's domination. It's a partnership. Nicodemus works with fallen as a near equal and of his free will. No one of the priesthood, of any of the knightly orders, of the Knights of the Cross, has so much as scratched him.
The noose, I guessed. The rope. It's like the shroud, isn't it? It has power.
Fort Hill nodded.
We think so, yes. The same rope the betrayer used in Jerusalem.
How many Denarians are working with him? I take it that they probably don't get along with each other.
You are correct, thank God.
Nicodemus rarely has more than 5 or 6 other Denarians working with him, according to our information. Usually he keeps 3 others nearby.
Snake Boy, Demon Girl, and Ursiel.
Yes.
How many coins are running around the world?
Only 9 are accounted for at this time, 10 with Ursiel's coin.
So Nicodemus could theoretically have 19 other fallen working with him, plus a side order of goons.
Goons?
Goons. Normal hired hands, they looked like.
Ah, they aren't normal, Fort Hill said. From what we've been able to tell, they are almost a small nation unto themselves. Fanatics. Their service is hereditary, passed on from father to son, mother to daughter.
This gets better and better, I said.
Harry, Fort Hill said. I know of no tactful way to ask this, so I will simply ask. Did he give you one of the coins?
He tried, I said. I turned him down.
Fort Hill's eyes stayed on my face for a moment, before he let out a breath.
I see. Do you remember the sigil upon it?
I grunted in affirmation, picked up a chocolate-covered jelly, and drew the symbol in the chocolate with a forefinger. Fort Hill tilted his head, frowning.
Lashiel, he murmured.
Lashiel? I said. It came out muffled since I was licking chocolate off my finger.
The seducer, Fort Hill murmured.
He smeared his finger over the chocolate, erasing the sigil.
Lashiel is also called the web weaver and the temptress, he said between licks.
Though it seems odd that Nicodemus would want to free her. Typically she does not follow Anduriel's lead.
A rebel angel among rebel angels?
Perhaps, Fort Hill said. It is something better not discussed for now. Susan stepped out of the little office, a wireless phone to her ear.
All right, she said to the phone, and walked past us, jerking one hand at us to tell us to follow her. Father Fort Hill lifted his eyebrows, and we went out to the Carpenter family's living room. It was a fairly huge room, divided into several clumps of furniture. The television was in the smallest clump, and still looked about 3 sizes too small. Susan marched over to it, flicked it on, and flipped through stations. She stopped on a local station, a news report that showed a helicopter angle of a building being consumed by a raging fire. About a dozen yellow and red fire trucks circled around it, but it was obvious that they were only containing the fire. The building was lost.
What's this? Fort Hill asked.
Damn it, I snarled and turned away from the television, pacing.
It's the building Shiro took us to last night, Susan said. The Denarians were in some tunnels beneath it.
Not anymore, I snapped. They've left and covered their tracks. Hell, they've had what, 6 hours? They could be a couple of states away by now.
Nicodemus, Forthill said. It's his style.
We'll find them, Susan said quietly.
How? I asked.
She pressed her lips together and turned away from me. She spoke quietly into the phone. I couldn't hear what she said, but it had that end-of-conversation tone to it. She turned the handset off a moment later. What can we do?
I can go to the underworld, I said. Call up some answers from there, but I can't do it until the sun sets.
Forthill said quietly,
You mustn't do that. It's far too dangerous. None of the knights would want.
I slashed my hand through the air, cutting him off. We need information, or Shiro is going to die.
Not only that, but if we don't run down Nicodemus, he gets to do whatever badness he's getting ready to do with the Shroud. If I have to go to down below for answers, then that's where I go.
What about Michael? Susan asked. Couldn't he find Shiro the way Shiro found Harry?
Forthill shook his head. Not necessarily. It isn't something he can control. At times, the knights are given that kind of discernment, but they can't call it up at will. I checked my watch, figuring up distances. Michael and Sonya should be back here in, what, an hour or so?
Barring further difficulties, Forthill said.
Fine. We'll see if the side of the angels wants to pitch in. If they don't, I'm calling Chauncey up as soon as the sun goes down.
I took the phone from Susan and walked out of the room.
Where are you going? Susan asked.
To talk to Anna Valmont. After that, I'm going to call my client. On the off chance I survive, I want to look like I at least tried to be professional.
Charity kept a guest room that had slowly been engulfed by a jungle of fabric. Clear boxes, full of the stuff in every imaginable color, stood stacked against one wall, and a small sewing machine sat on a table, barely visible among neatly folded stacks of more. More boxes of fabric had been stacked into a rampart around a single bed, which was occupied by a lump buried underneath several quilts. I turned on a small lamp on the sewing table and hoped that the room wouldn't burst into flame.
Anna, wake up.
The lump made a mumbling sound and stirred before settling again. I turned the phone on and let the dial tone sound in the room's silence.
I know you're awake, Miss Valmont, and you know that I saved your ass back at the Marriott. So if you don't sit up and talk to me right now, I'm calling the cops to come pick you up.
She didn't move. I punched in a number and let the phone start to ring.
Bastard, she muttered.
She sat up, her expression wary, holding the covers to her front. Her shoulders were bare.
Very well. What do you want?
My coat, for starters, I said. But since I doubt you're palming it, I'll settle for the name of your buyer.
She stared at me for a moment before she said, If I tell you that, it could kill me.
If you don't, I'm turning you over to the police. She shrugged.
Which, while unpleasant, won't kill me. Besides, you intend to turn me over in any case.
I scowled at her.
I saved your life, twice. I am aware of that, she said.
She stared through me for a moment before she said,
It's so hard to believe. Even though it happened to me, it seems mad, like a dream.
You aren't crazy, I said, or at least you aren't hallucinating or anything.
She half laughed. I know. Siska is dead. Gaston is dead. It happened to them. My friends.
Her voice broke, and she started blinking very quickly.
I just wanted to finish it, so that they didn't die for nothing at all. I owed it to them.
I sighed. Look, I'll make this easy for you. Was it Marcone? She shrugged without focusing her eyes.
We went through an intermediary, so I can't be sure.
But was it Marcone? Valmont nodded.
If I had to guess, I would say it was. The buyer was someone with a great deal of money and local influence.
Does he know that you know?
One doesn't mention to the buyer that you know who he is when he's taking precautions to prevent it. It's impolite.
If you know anything about Marcone, you know that he isn't going to pay you off and let you walk away without delivering, I said. She rubbed at her eyes.
I'll offer to return it.
Good idea, assuming he doesn't kill you before you finish offering. She glared at me for a second, angry and crying. What do you want from me? I picked up a box of tissues from behind a bunch of yellow cotton on the table and offered it to her.
Information. I want to know everything. It's possible you've heard or seen something that might help me recover the shroud. Help me out, and I might be able to buy you some time to leave town.
She took the box and blotted her eyes on a tissue.
How do I know you will deliver on that promise?
Earth to Larceny Spies. Come in, Larceny Spies. I saved your life twice. I think you can safely assume goodwill.
She looked down, biting her lip.
I don't know.
This is a limited-time offer. She drew in a shaking breath.
All right. All right, let me clean up a little. Get dressed. I'll tell you what I know.
Fine, I said. Come on, there's a shower in the bathroom at the end of the hall. I'll get you towels and stuff.
Is this your house?
Friends, but I've stayed here before. She nodded and fished around until she came up with the black shirt she'd been wearing the night before. She slipped into it and rose. She had long, pretty, and bruised legs, and as she stepped onto her right leg, she let out a pained cry and fell forward. I caught her before she could hit the ground, and she leaned into me, lifting her right foot from the floor.
Bloody hell, she wheezed. I must have twisted my ankle last night.
She shot me a hard-eyed glance. Hands. I jerked my hand off something pleasantly smooth and firm. Sorry, accident. Can you manage? She shook her head, balanced on one leg.
I don't think so. Lend me your arm a moment.
I helped her hobble down the hall and into the bathroom. I dug some more towels out of the linen closet, then passed them into her through a mostly closed door. She locked it behind her and started the shower. I shook my head and went back down the hall, dialing Father Vincent's phone number. On the fifth ring, he answered, his voice sounding tired and strained.
Vincent.
It's Harry Dresden, I said. I know where the shroud came into Chicago and who is buying. It got intercepted by a third party, and they have it now.
You're certain? Vincent demanded.
Yeah.
Do you know what it is?
Not exactly, but I'm going to find out. I should know by this evening, maybe sooner.
Why will it take until this evening? Vincent asked.
Well, it's a little hard to explain, I said.
Perhaps the police should handle the rest of the investigation.
I'd advise against it.
Why?
I have some information that indicates your mistrusts may not have been misplaced.
Oh,
Vincent said. His voice sounded worried.
I think we should meet and talk, Mr. Dresden. I'd rather not discuss this over the phone. 2 o'clock, at the room we spoke in last?
I can probably do that, I said.
Until then, said Vincent, and hung up.
I paced back into the living room and found Susan sitting and reading the morning paper with coffee and a donut. One of the sliding glass doors that had previously led to the back patio was open, and on the other side was a lot of bare wood and plastic, the addition Michael was building. The rasping of a saw came through the open door. I stepped out and found Father Forthill at work. He'd taken off his coat and collar. He had a short-sleeved black shirt underneath. He wore leather work gloves and safety glasses. He finished sawing a beam and blew dust off the cut before rising.
How is Father Vincent?
Sounds tired, I said. I'm going to talk to him later, assuming we don't have something going on first.
I worry for him, Forthill said.
He held up the beam to the top of what would eventually be a window.
Here, hold this for me.
I did. Forthill started driving in a few nails, clenching several in his teeth.
And Miss Valmont?
Taking a shower. She's going to cooperate with us. Forthill frowned, taking a nail from his lips.
I really wouldn't have expected that from her, from the sense I had of her.
It's my charming personality, I said. The ladies can't resist.
Hmm,
Forthill said around the nails.
It's the only decent thing to do, and her back is against a wall, right?
Forthill drove the nail in and frowned. He looked at me. I looked back at him for a moment and then said,
I'll just go check on her.
I got about halfway across the living room before I heard a car door shut, immediately followed by a car engine. I ran to the front door and threw it open just in time to see the shattered rear window of the Blue Beetle zipping down the street and out of sight. I fumbled at my pockets and groaned. My keys were missing.
Son of a bitch,
I snarled. I punched the door frame in sheer frustration. I didn't punch it very hard. I was angry, not looking to break my own knuckles.
The old stumble and bump, and I fell for it.
Susan stepped up beside me and sighed.
Harry, you idiot. You're a good man, but an idiot where women are concerned.
First my coat, and now my car. That's freaking gratitude for you. Susan nodded.
No good deed goes unpunished.
I stared at her. Are you laughing at me? She faced me from behind a perfectly straight face, but her voice sounded a little choked.
No.
You are. Her face turned pink and she shook her head. Laughing at my pain. She turned and walked back to the living room and picked up her paper. She sat down and held it up so that I couldn't see her face. Choked sounds came out from behind the paper. I stalked back out to the addition, growling. Fort Hill looked back at me, his eyebrows raised. Give me something to break, or hit really hard, I told him. His eyes sparkled.
You'll hurt yourself. Here, hold this for me.
I lifted another cut board into place while Fort Hill reached up to hammer it in. As he did, the sleeve of his shirt tugged up and showed me a pair of green lines. Wait, I said, and snapped my hand over his arm. The board slipped out of my other hand and bonked me on the head on the way down. I scowled at it, wincing, but tugged the sleeve up. Fort Hill had a tattoo on the inside of his right arm. An eye of Thoth. What is this? I demanded. Fort Hill looked around and tugged his sleeve back down. A tattoo?
Duh, a tattoo. I know that. What does it mean?
It's something I had done when I was younger, he answered. An organization I belonged to. I tried to calm down, but my voice still sounded harsh.
What organization?
Fort Hill blinked mildly at me.
I don't understand why you're so upset, Harry.
What organization? He continued to look confused.
Just several of us who took our orders together. We were barely more than boys, really, and we'd happened on to some of the stranger events of our day, and records of others. A vampire had killed two people in town, and we stopped it together. No one believed us, of course.
Of course, I said. What about the tattoo? Fort Hill pursed his lips, thoughtful.
I haven't thought about it in so long.
Well, the next morning we went out and got the tattoos. We swore an oath to be always watchful against the forces of darkness, to help one another whenever we could. Then what?
After the hangovers faded, we went a very good distance out of our way to make sure none of the senior clergy saw them, Fort Hill responded, smiling faintly. We were young.
And then?
And then no other supernatural events presented themselves over the next few years, and the five of us drifted apart. Until I heard from Father Vincent last week, I hadn't spoken to any of them in years.
Wait, Vincent has a tattoo like this?
I suppose he could have had it removed. He might be the sort to do that.
What about the others in the group?
Passed away over the last several years, Fort Hill said. He stripped off one of the work gloves and regarded his weathered hand. Back then, I don't think any of us thought we would ever live to be so old.
The wheels spun in my head, and I got it. I understood what was happening and why. On pure intuition, I stalked to the front of the house, gathering up my things on the way. Father Fort Hill followed me.
Harry?
I walked past Susan, who set her paper aside and stood up to follow me.
Harry?
I got to the front door and jerked it open. The engine of Michael's white pickup rattled to a halt as I did, and he and Sonya got out of the truck. They looked a little rumpled and unshaven, but fine. Michael blinked at me and asked,
Harry? I think I just saw a woman driving your car toward the highway. What's going on?
Get anything you need for a fight, I said. We're going.
Chapter 28. When Father Vincent answered my knock, I kicked the door into his face as hard as I could. He fell back with a grunt of surprise. I came into the room with Father Forthill's Louisville slugger in my hands and jabbed the broad end of the bat into Vincent's throat. The old priest made a sick, croaking sound and clutched at his neck on the way to the floor. I didn't let it stop there. I kicked him in the ribs twice, and when he rolled over, trying to get away from me, I stomped down on the back of his neck, drew my gun, and shoved it against his skull.
Dio! Vincent whimpered, panting. Dio! Wait! Please, don't hurt me!
I don't have time to play pretend, I said. Drop the act.
Please, Mr. Dresden, I don't know what you mean.
He coughed, panting, and I saw droplets of scarlet dripping onto the carpet. I'd bloodied his nose, or maybe his lip. He turned his head a tiny bit, eyes wide with panic.
Please, don't do anything to me. I don't know what you want, but I'm sure that we can talk about it.
I drew back the hammer on the revolver and said, I'm sure that we can't. His face went white.
No, wait!
I'm getting tired of playing pretend. Three.
But I don't know.
He choked, and I heard him trying not to retch.
You have to tell me.
Two, I said. I'm not going to elaborate about the other number.
You can't! You can't!
One, I said, and pulled the trigger. In the instant between the word and the deed, Vincent changed. A sheath of green scales appeared over his skin, and his legs twined together into a serpent's long and sinuous body. The eyes went last, changing to vertically slit yellow orbs, while a second set of glowing green eyes opened above the first. The trigger came down on an empty chamber. Click. The snake twisted to bite me, but I was already getting out of the way. Michael came through the door, his unshaven face set in grim determination. Amorakius blazing with its own white light. The snake man whirled to face Michael with a hiss. Michael tried for a clean, horizontal cut, but the snake man ducked under it and went for the door in a streak of gleaming green scales. When the snake man went out the door, Sonya brought a 4-foot length of 2x6 down on its head. The blow drove the snake man's chin flat to the ground. It twitched a couple of times and then lay still.
You were right, Michael noted. He slipped the sword away into its sheath.
Better get him back inside before some maid sees him, I said. Michael nodded, grabbing the snake man's tail, and hauled him back into the hotel room. Sonya looked in, nodded, and set the end of the length of heavy board down with a certain amount of satisfaction. I realized he'd used the thing with one arm. Good grief. I needed to get to the gym.
Good, the big Russian said. Let me put this back in the truck. I will join you.
A few minutes later, the snake man woke up in the corner of the hotel room with me, Michael, and Sonya standing over him. His tongue flickered out and in a few times, and his two sets of eyes darted around the room.
What did I miss?
It hissed. A tattoo, I said. Father Vincent had a tattoo on the inside of his right arm.
There was no tattoo,
the snake man insisted.
Maybe it was covered with all the blood. You made a stupid mistake. It's understandable. Most criminals aren't all that bright, so you were working uphill from the get-go.
The snake man hissed, shifting its scales restlessly, a cobra-like hood flaring around its neck and shoulders. Michael drew Amorakius. Sonya did the same with Esperakius. The two blades threw pure white light over the snake man, and he subsided, flinching back from them.
What do you want?
To talk, I said. See, the way it works is that I ask you questions. You answer them. And as long as you do, we'll all be happy.
And if I don't?
The snake man hissed. I get a new pair of boots. The snake's scales and coils twined around on one another, rasping. Its eyes remained on the two knights.
Ask.
Here's what I figure happened. Somehow your glee club heard that the church mice were being hired to find and take the shroud. You thought you'd just nip it from them on their way out of town, but you missed. You caught Gaston Laroche, but he didn't have the shroud. So you tortured him until he told you everything.
And after he told us everything,
the snake man said,
Nicodemus was indulging his little bitch.
I think it's sweet to see a father and daughter doing things together. So you found out what Laroche knew, killed him, and left his body where it would be found.
Pointed at where the shroud was going. You figured you'd let the mortal authorities do the work of finding them for you, and take the shroud when they did.
drudge work, unworthy of us.
You're going to hurt my feelings, Snake Boy. You found out who the church was sending over, then you grabbed poor Father Vincent at the airport. You took his place.
Any infant could reason as much,
the Denarian hissed. I pulled up a chair and sat. Here's where it gets interesting, because you decided to hire me on. Why?
Why do you think?
To keep tabs on the knights, I said. Or to distract them by making them try to keep me out of the search. Or maybe you thought I could really turn up the shroud for you. Probably all three. No sense doing things for one reason when you can fit in a few ulterior motives for free. You even gave me a sample of the shroud to make it more likely I'd find it. I leaned back in the chair. That's where I started seeing something wrong. I talked to Marcone about his new thug gunning for me, and he blinked.
I don't know what you're talking about,
the snake man said. Marcone was the buyer. A cold laugh slithered out of the snake man's mouth.
A mortal, nothing more.
Yeah, well, the mortal figured out that Father Vincent had been replaced, and he sent an assassin to kill you. The new guy wasn't shooting at me outside of Fowler's studio. He was after you.
Impossible, the snake man said.
Pride goeth, Legs. Marcone wasn't born yesterday.
I am sure you have pleased yourself with your cleverness, wizard.
It gets better, I said brightly. See, Nicodemus didn't let much drop. Other than that, he was on a deadline and he needed someone savvy to the supernatural. His daughter did, though. She asked if he didn't want a silver bowl. That's a ceremonial bowl, and if I was guessing, I'd say it was meant to be used to catch lifeblood. Fuel a ritual. The snake man's tail lashed around restlessly. I think Father Vincent was a warm-up, a test for the ritual. I think he came over here with two samples from the shroud, and you used one of them as the focus for the plague curse that killed him. Once you knew it would work, you went after the shroud itself.
You know nothing, wizard,
said the snake man. The glowing sigil on his forehead throbbed in time with the extra set of eyes.
You are pathetic.
You're hurting my feelings. Don't make me get the baseball bat, I said. Nicodemus covered his tracks this morning by burning down the building you'd been in. I suppose he sent you to cover everything up nice and neat with the cops and with me. I think he's got something in mind, and I think it's tonight. So, why not make this a comparatively pleasant discussion and tell me all about it?
Do you think that you frighten me, wizard?
Said the Denarian.
I was destroying men more powerful than you before this pathetic nation was born.
Where is Nicodemus, and what is he doing with the shroud? I'll give you a hint. It's got something to do with a plague curse.
I have served Nicodemus since...
Since my last dental appointment, I get it, I said. But let me point something out to you. Nicodemus isn't here. I held my palms out to either side of me, Vanna White style. These two gentlemen are very much here, and very much angry. Sonya stared at the Denarian, the saber in his hand swishing back and forth a little. He growled. It was enough to make me want to edge away from him. Look, I told him, we're going to find Nicodemus and push his face in. We're going to shut down whatever he's got in mind, and we're going to get Shiro back, and you're going to tell us what we need to know.
Or,
Michael said in a very quiet voice, I end you. The snake man stared at me for a very long time. Then he started to rasp and shake. It took me a minute to realize that he was laughing at me. Snakes weren't really meant for laughter. It didn't sit well on a serpentine body.
You cannot threaten me, he said. There's nothing you can do to me.
I see a couple of holy swords here that make me think otherwise.
No,
the Denarian said. He reached up to his forehead and clawed at the sigil there, as if trying to peel off his own skin. The symbol flashed and then faded, along with the second set of eyes. The whole of him rippled, scales abruptly melting away. For a second, the features of Father Vincent emerged from beneath the scales. Then they too faded away, replaced by a man's pinched and hardened features. He was dark of skin, maybe Moorish, and he wasn't big. 5 feet and a little change, and not more than 150. Average height, several centuries ago. The man lowered his hand and let a slightly tarnished silver coin roll across the floor to Michael's feet.
My name is Quintus Cassius, and I have long been slave to the will of the demon Saluriel.
His dark eyes glittered with malice, and his tone dripped with sarcasm.
I beg you for mercy and the chance to mend my ways. However can I thank you, Sir Knight, for saving me from that torment? Shit.
He was playing the morality card. I shot a glance at Michael. The big man frowned at Snake Boy Cassius, but didn't miss a beat in drawing out a white handkerchief embroidered with a silver cross and folding the coin up in it. Michael and Sonya exchanged a long look, and then both of them put away their swords.
Guys, what the hell are you doing?
Dangerous demon murderer here, remember?
Harry, Michael said, we can't. Not if he surrendered the coin and asked mercy.
What? I demanded. That's stupid.
Of course it is,
Cassius said. Glee danced in his voice.
They know that I am not sincere. They know I will turn on them at the first opportunity, that I will obtain one of the other coins and return to what I have done for centuries.
I stood up, angry enough that the chair fell over. Michael, if you turn the other cheek on this bastard, he'll tear it off your face. You're supposed to be the freaking fist of God.
No, I'm not, Harry, Michael said. The purpose of the knights is not to destroy those who serve evil.
Indeed not,
Cassius said. Somehow there was more of a hiss in his voice now than when he'd been a snake.
They're here to save us.
To save them? I stared at Michael. Is he kidding? Michael shook his head.
No one else can face the Denarians, Harry. No one else can challenge the Fallen. This moment might be the only chance Cassius has to turn aside from what he has chosen, to change his path.
Great, I'm all for changing his path. Let's change it to a direct line to the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Michael's expression was pained. The knights are here to protect freedom, to give those who are under the oppression of dark forces the chance to win free of them. I cannot sit in judgment on this man's soul, Harry Dresden. Not for you, not for anyone. All I can do is remain faithful to my calling. Give him the chance to see hope for his future. To show him the love and compassion any human being should show another. The rest is out of my hands. I watched Cassius's face while Michael spoke. His expression changed. It became harder, more brittle, and bitter.
What Michael said had touched him. I didn't believe for a second that it had touched Cassius enough to change his mind, but it touched him enough to drive him toward fury. I turned to Michael and said,
"Do you really think that thing is going to start sipping of the milk of human kindness?"
"No," Michael said. "But that doesn't change my purpose. He has surrendered his coin and the influence of it. The rest is not for Sonya or me to decide. It is Cassius's choice."
"You've seen these things," I snarled, stalking over to face Michael. "I've seen the corpses they've left. They would have killed me, Susan, you, hell, all of us, without blinking an eye. God only knows what they have in mind with that curse they're putting together."
"All power has its limits, Harry," he shook his head. "This is the limit of mine."
Without really thinking about it, I shoved his shoulder. "They might already have killed Shiro, and you're going to let this bastard walk?" Michael caught my arm in one hand and twisted. Michael is strong. I had to rise up onto my toes to relieve the pressure he put on my elbow, and he shoved me back from him, his eyes hard and cold and angry as hell.
"I know that," he said, in that same deadly quiet voice. "I know they've hurt him. That they're going to kill him. Just as Shiro knew that Nicodemus would betray his promise to set you free. It's one of the things that makes us different than they are, Harry."
The blood on their hands does not make it right to bloody my own. My choices are measured against my own soul, not against the stains on theirs." He looked at Cassius, and the Denarian flinched away from the silent flame.